Bokir Tov, Chodesh Tov. Before the elections for the first Knesset here in Israel in January 1949, a number of Gdolei Torah issued a kol kore, a proclamation urging their flock to participate in Israel's first elections, stating that it is a mitzvah to vote, a mitzvah. And so the Belzer Rebbe of Avron Rokeach was approached by one of his chassidim, who asked, "Rebbe, is it really a mitzvah to vote? Is it a mitzvah like eating matzah?" And Rebbe thought for a moment, and he stroked his beard, and he quipped, "Maybe it's more like the mitzvah of eating maror, bitter herbs." You can laugh or not. It's not my joke, so I won't be offended if you don't laugh. But for many frustrated Israelis, voting next week in a fifth election within the span of 3 years feels a lot like eating maror. But the question I'd like to explore together with you this morning is participating in Israel's electoral process just a mere civic duty, or is it a mitzvah? Is it a mitzvah to vote in Israel's elections? That's our question this morning. Now, the Torah here in source number one, Dvarim Perek Yud Zayin, it's Parashat Shoftim, the Torah commands, Som tasim alech hamelech, you shall surely place upon yourself a king, set over yourself a king, asher yivchar Hashem elokecha, bo mikerev achecha, tasim alech hamelech, lo tuchal atet alech ish nachri, asher lo achicha, a king whom Hashem, your God, shall choose. And he has to be from among your brethren. He cannot be a foreigner. He can't be a Gentile. And we learn different halachot from that. But we have a mitzvah min haTorah to appoint a king. Now the truth is, it's a major machloket, major discussion, dispute, debate, whether that mitzvah is lechatchila or bidiavad, because in the previous pasuk, it would seem, according to some, that it's really when the Jewish people enter their land and they dwell in it, and then they say to themselves, "Amarta asima alay melech kechol agoyim asher svivotai." They maybe want a king in order to be like all of the nations around them. So there's a whole discussion. Is this mitzvah lechatchila, or is it only if they request a king to be like the other nations? Is this an ideal, or is this something that's less than ideal? But in any case, many assume that it is indeed a mitzvah. And in fact, the Rambam here writes, based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin and the Sifrei Tere'ei, in source number 2, the Rambam writes that one of the three mitzvot that are incumbent upon the Jewish people when they enter into the land of Israel is to appoint a king. The Rambam writes, Shalosh mitzvot nitzdavu Yisrael bishat knisatan la'aretz. There are three mitzvot that the Jewish people have to fulfill when they enter into the land of Israel. And the first one is lemanot lehem melech, shenemar som tasim alecha melech. It's to appoint a king. As the pasuk that we began with says, you shall place upon yourself a king, place a king over you. Ulachrit zaro shel Amalek, they have to destroy Amalek. And v'livnot beit bechira, they have to build a beit hamikdash. Okay. And actually, if you look back at source number one, pasuk yudal begins kitavo el haaretz, when you enter into the land. So the Torah itself instructs that when they enter into the land, they have to place a king upon themselves. Okay. So, but what about today? We don't have a king, right? We have a Knesset. We have a parliament. I always point out to my kids, I ask them, you know, how many Chavrei Knesset are there? How many members of parliament are there here in Israel? And they say there's 120, right? And over the past few years, it's been very difficult because we have so many different parties. No one's been able to successfully establish a coalition. No one has enough mandates, enough seats. You need a majority of 61, because there are 120 members of Knesset, and it's to form a coalition, you need a majority, you need at least 61. We'll see what happens this election. We'll see what happens next week. But hopefully we won't have to have more elections. But unfortunately, the polls are looking like it doesn't seem like Netanyahu, either the right or the left Gush, will be able to form a coalition, unfortunately. There needs to be electoral reform here in Israel. That's obvious. But in any case, I always remind my kids there are 120 members of Knesset Yisrael, and that's not just stam, that's not just arbitrary, but there's a reason for that. Why did they choose 120 members of the Knesset? Any suggestions? Any ideas? Anyone know? Because there were, well, the 12 tribes, that's an interesting suggestion. There were 120 members of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the greatest Sanhedrin, right? So corresponding to that, we have 100. So it's symbolic. I think significant that there are 120 members of Knesset. In any case, the Torah commands us to place a king over ourselves. And so what about today? You know, with the return of the Jewish people to their ancestral homeland in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, questions that for almost 2,000 years were but the subject of dreams all of a sudden became reality. Halacha lamaisa, right? Are you permitted to create a democratic government? Right? Can you elect officials, or do you have to place a king? Are we required to have a monarchy? Malchut Beit David. I mean, are we allowed? And you had many, many poskim. We'll see shortly a very important tshuva from Rav Kook, but many poskim question, you know, are we allowed to create a government, or do we have to appoint a king? And can you appoint a king from, you know, just among the Jewish people? A king has to come from the tribe of Judah, from the Davidic line, the Davidic dynasty, Malchut Beit David. Maybe there's room to appoint a temporary king if he doesn't come from Malchut Beit David, doesn't come from Yehudah. We don't have a Sanhedrin. Can we restore a Sanhedrin? And there were questions in terms of, can we even create a self-defense organization? This is before before Israel's defense forces, the IDF, before we had an army, but pre-state, there were questions. Can we create some sort of militia group or militia groups, some sort of self-defense organization to protect the yeshuv, because, you know, there's violence and there's theft from the neighbors? And there were poskim, interestingly, that opposed that, because they felt that, you know, if you look in the Torah, if you look in the Mishnah and the Gemara, it would seem that the king and the Sanhedrin are in charge of an army. And maybe we don't have the authority to create some sort of army without a king, without a Sanhedrin. In any case, all of these questions all of a sudden became relevant. And so we'll see in a few moments a very, very important tshuva from Rav Kook, where Rav Kook justifies the creation of a Jewish sovereign nation in our land, meaning creating a state with elected officials, even in the absence of a king. In other words, monarchy is not the only form of governance that's acceptable. And we'll see that he does, he argues this really based on a very interesting stira in the Rambam, an apparent contradiction, where the Rambam, lichora, seemingly contradicts himself, or appears to contradict himself. So take a look back at source number 2. In Halacha Gimel, the Rambam writes, Ein ma'amidin melech b'tchila, ela al pi beidin shel shivim zekenim, ve'al pi navi. In order to appoint a king, there's a process. It has to be done through a beidin of 70 elders, that's the Sanhedrin, ve'al pi navi, and through a prophet. Okay? And interestingly, in Halacha Chet, he just mentions Navi. Right? Navi she'mid melech mishar shifte Yisrael. Where is the Sanhedrin? And then, in source number 3, in Hilchot Sanhedrin, in the 5th chapter there, Hilchot Sanhedrin, Perek Hei Halacha Aleph, the Rambam writes, Ein ma'midin melech ela al pi beidin shel shivim ve'echad. You can only appoint a king through a Beit Din of 71. Where's the Navi? Where's the Navi? And interestingly, if you go back to Hilchot Malachim Perek Aleph, Halacha Gimel, he writes, Ein Ma'bidin Melech Bitchila, in the beginning, at the outset. And so, it would seem that, you know, Rav Kook, before we get to Rav Kook, sorry, that the Rambam, it would seem, appears to contradict himself, right? In one place he writes that you need both a Navi, a prophet, and a Sanhedrin to appoint a king. Another place he writes, a Navi can appoint a king. And another place he writes, a Sanhedrin can appoint a king. Right? So which one is it? Do you need both the Navi and the Sanhedrin? Or if you have a Sanhedrin without a Navi, is that also acceptable? And so Rav Kook, as we'll see here in this very important Tshuva, in source number 4, Rav Kook explains this apparent contradiction in the Rambam. And Rav Kook suggests that there's lechatchila and there's bidyeved. There is the ideal, and then there's the reality. The ideal is that, yes, lechatchila, you need to appoint a king through both a Sanhedrin and a Navi, a prophet. But historically, and interestingly, he draws in his tshuva on the Chashmonaim. We're not the picture of perfection. We've spoken about the Chashmonaim in the past here. We've had Shirim over Hanukkah. So, and I think that's significant and symbolic, and I've spoken about that in the past here. But Rav Kook explains that, for instance, during the period of the Chashmonaim, there were no longer prophets. That was during the Second Temple period. The period of prophecy had already ceased. So what do? Okay, you can still appoint a king. At the time, there was a Sanhedrin. But what happens if you don't have a Sanhedrin? So Rav Kook, here in this tshuva here, in source number 4, and this is a very, very significant tshuva. This is a tshuva that Rav Kook wrote when he was in St. Gallen, Switzerland. You know that when Rav Kook was traveling to Europe for medical treatment and to participate in the major conference, the Knesset HaGdolah of Agudas Yisrael, all of a sudden, World War I broke out, and Rav Kook was stranded in Europe for a number of years. He couldn't get back to the land of Israel. First, he was in St. Gallen, Switzerland, and then he accepted the invitation of the Machzike Adas in London to be the Rav there in London, for the Machzike Adas. So this was written in Tevet of Tuf Resh Ayin Vav. That's 1916. Okay, this is when Rav Kook is writing this tshuva. And this tshuva here is written to someone Rav Kook became very close with, Rav Shlomo Zalman Pines. He was a rabbi there in Switzerland, big Talmud Chacham. And Rav Pines, and this is part of a series of tshuvot that are published in the Mishpat Kohen of Rav Kook. Rav Pines was inquiring about this very question, as I mentioned, following the second Aliyah in the early 20th century, you had these militia groups. You had Hashomer, you had Bar Giora, you had, you had Haganah, and these were self-defense organizations that sprung up in order to protect the yeshuv from, again, violence from their neighbors and theft, etc. Okay? And these were very important groups, but surprisingly, there were leading rabbis that were opposed. There was a lot of opposition. Because as I said before, they felt, we don't have the authority, we don't have a king, we don't have a Sanhedrin, how can we create some sort of military? The laws of Milchama are related to the laws of Melucha. In fact, the Rambam, we've been quoting so far from the Rambam in Hilchot Malachim, in the laws of kings, that's where the Rambam records the laws of war. Right? Because it's the king who takes the Jewish people into war. And if it's Milchemet Rishut, it's with the permission of the Sanhedrin. So what if you don't have a king, you don't have a Sanhedrin? So can you, so to speak, go to war? Or the question at the time was, can you create these self-defense organizations? And surprisingly, there were many rabbis who were against this. So in this tshuva, Rav Kook, he defends the establishment of these organizations, the creation of these organizations, and he also defends the creation of a state, of a government, of a sovereign nation here in our homeland, in the absence of a king, in the absence of a Sanhedrin. And what he says is just like the Rambam writes, in one place you need the Sanhedrin and a king, the Sanhedrin and a Navi to appoint a king, but another place it's enough with the Sanhedrin. Well, that's assuming there is no longer a Navi. And as I said, he draws on the period of the Hashmonaim and says, yeah, they appointed a king, and even from another tribe. The Hashmonaim were not from the tribe of Judah. They did not come from Malchut Beit David. The Ramban, for instance, is very critical of them. He sees them as usurpers. They've usurped the throne from Malchut Beit David, from the tribe of Yehuda. Lo yasur shevet miyuda, the Torah says at the end of Sefer Breshit. It's one of the brachot that Yaakov gives to his children. He gives Yehuda the bracha that the scepter will never leave Judah. So Rav Kook, however, he draws on this apparent contradiction in the Rambam that we just saw, and says, yeah, lechachila, ideally, you need both a Sanhedrin and a prophet to appoint a king. You don't have a prophet anymore because the period of prophecy is no longer. So then it's enough with a Sanhedrin. And that's what happened in the days of the Hashmonaim. Okay? Yes, less than ideal. For many reasons. I think, as I said, it's very symbolic and significant that Rav Kook draws on the Hashmonaim, who were not the picture of perfection. We know that ultimately they caved to the very Hellenism that they had initially fought against. Okay, subsequently there was all sorts of corruption and even political assassinations and murder. I mean, you know, very, very difficult period. Not Pashut. So, it's significant, I think, that Rav Kook draws on them. He says, yeah, maybe it's not the ideal, but this is the reality. Okay, and so Rav Kook then, after saying, you see, in one place the Rambam says you need both a Sanhedrin and a Navi. And in another place, it's enough with the Sanhedrin. Okay, that's assuming there is no longer a Navi. The period of prophecy has ceased. So then Rav Kook takes to the next, takes the next step. Right, the extension of that would be, what if you no longer have a Sanhedrin? So then Rav Kook suggests that yes, you can appoint a king, or not necessarily a king. You could appoint a governor or some sort of governing body through consensus. Haskamat ha'uma. That's the key word in this tshuva here in source number 4. The consensus of the nation. Now, of course, the concept of the umma in the thought of Rav Kook is very significant, as you all know. For Rav Kook, there's a tremendous koach, a tremendous power to the nation. So Rav Kook writes here in source number 4, take a look at the next page where I've underlined. Just for the sake of time, we'll just skip to some of the key passages here in this very important tshuva. And by the way, this tshuva said is so important because besides for justifying the creation of a sovereign nation, of a democratic state, this tshuva also talks about the laws of war and pikuach nefesh and mesirut nefesh, sacrificing oneself, self-sacrifice. And this tshuva, I gave you only a section of what is a very lengthy tshuva and a series of a number of tshuvot on the topic, but this tshuva is often cited where in the context of the discussion of the laws of war and battlefield ethics and these moral and ethical dilemmas on the battlefield and self-sacrifice, etc. So look where I've underlined. He writes, V'chutz mizeh nir'im hadvarim, shebizman she'in melech. Right? What if you've returned to your land and there is no Sanhedrin, there is no Navi, and there is no king? Okay, what do you do? שבזמן שאין מלך, כיוון שמשפטי המלוכה הם גם כמה שנוגע למצב הכללי של האומה. Since governance is really about the needs of the people and their welfare, חוזרים אלה הזכויות של המשפטים ליד האומה בכללה. The rights of governance are returned or restored to the nation in its entirety. ובייחוד נראה שגם כל שופט שקם בישראל דין מלך יש לו לעניין כמה משפטי המלוכה. ובייחוד And so then he says something really interesting that could be interpreted in different ways and taken in different directions. But he says that it would appear that any leader that is appointed, that arises in Israel, has the din of a king concerning, at least, governing the people, governing the nation. Now, what does it mean that he has the status of a king? So, there is this school of thought, and I do not believe that this is what Rav Kook intended, but there is this approach called mamlachtiyut. Mamlachtiyut. People that are mamlachtim, who take this statement of Rav Kook literally. That they believe, Rav Kook is saying, that when we return to our land and elect officials to govern us, they have the status of a Melech Yisrael. And just like you are not allowed, we'll talk about it in a few moments, you're not allowed to rebel against a Melech Yisrael. You can't be Moreid B'Malchut. We have to do what they say. We have to listen to them. We can't challenge them. There is such a school of thought. And this came to a head during the Hitnatkut, during the disengagement from Gush Katif. Some call it the Geirush from Gush Katif, the expulsion, where there were Rabbanim who told their flock and instructed their students that they are not to be Misarev Pekuda. You can't refuse the orders. And if you do, you're Moreid B'Malchut. Now, being Moreid B'Malchut, rebelling against the king, is punished. It's punishable by the death penalty. It's a serious crime. Okay? So, this concept of mamlachtiyut has been used, halacha lemaisa. We saw it not too long ago with the disengagement. But I don't believe that that's what Rav Kook intended here. I think Rav Kook is seemingly, or Rav Kook is merely trying to justify and reconcile, really, reconcile with the sources that we have and justify the creation of a sovereignty, of a sovereign nation, of a government in the absence of a Sanhedrin, in the absence of a Navi, in the absence of a king. That we can elect officials, the Ummah, the nation, the Haskamata Ummah, through consensus, through the democratic process, has the authority to appoint governors over them, to elect officials. Okay, and in a sense, they are like the king, that they can govern the nation, but they don't have the complete status of a Melech Yisrael. And then at the end here, where I've underlined, Aval kishmitmane manhig ha'uma l'chol tzracheha b'signon malchuti. Here he throws in the word signon malchuti. Again, I don't think Rav Kook is saying that the elected officials are the king and have the same status as a Melech Bisrael, but b'signon malchuti, it's similar, it's in the style of a Melech Bisrael, in that they govern us, in that they rule over us, in that they establish law, in that they can even punish. There can be punishments. Okay, al pi dat haklal v'dat beit din. It has to be through the dat, the consensus, you translate literally as the mindset or the opinion, but it means consensus here, the consensus of the public and the Beit Din. Vaday omed hu b'makom melech. He certainly stands in the place of a king. Le'inyan mishpatei hamlucha hanogim lahanhagat haklal. Again, I don't think Rav Kook is saying he is the king, or that, you know, some people think Bibi is the melech, right? Bibi's the king. He's saying that the elected officials are in place of a Melech Yisrael, in that they have the right to govern. You give them the right to govern. You can elect officials over yourself. And this, the truth is, there's a lot of literature on this, how we have the authority today to elect officials. There are a whole series of tshuvot in a very, very important work called Malki Bakodesh of Rav Chaim Hirshenson. Rav Chaim Hirshenson was a very fascinating individual. He, it's interesting. People think that Eliezer ben Yehuda, this secular Zionist who is responsible for the revival of the Hebrew language, they think that, you know, he did it all by himself. People think that modern Hebrew is the product of these secular Zionists who threw off the yoke of Torah and mitzvot. But he consulted with rabbis. Among them was Rav Chaim Hirshenson. Rav Chaim Hirshenson was a brilliant, brilliant Talmud Chacham who worked with Eliezer ben Yehuda on reviving the Hebrew language. And modern Hebrew draws a lot from the Hebrew of the Mishnah and Safrut Chazal and Midrash and the Rambam, etc. So there was a lot of rabbinic influence in Eliezer ben Yehuda's work. But in any case, Chaim Hirshenson, big Talmud Chacham, and he left actually Israel because of the Kanaim. He was driven out, maybe, because of all the radicals here who were against him. He had very positive feelings towards Zionism, but he was a very traditional rabbi, and he became the rabbi of this whole area in New Jersey by the Lincoln Tunnel. Jersey City and the whole Hudson County area, Union City, Hoboken, West New York, that whole area there. If you look at Weehawken, Hoboken, Jersey, this whole area in Hudson County, Newark, that whole area, he was the Rav of that area. And he wrote a series of tshuvot called Malki Bakodesh, where he talks about creating a democratic state in the land of Israel. This is pre-state. He was a visionary. He was very influenced by de Tocqueville. Okay, who influenced the founding fathers of the United States. So he's talking about sort of, creating a democracy here in Israel. And if you take a look at source number 5, it would seem that the Radbaz also understands that you can create some form of governance. You can elect officials through the Haskamat Ha'umah, like we saw in this Tshuvah of Kook, through the consensus of the nation, of the people, even without, again, a Sanhedrin, or a Navi, a prophet, or a king. And here he writes, and this is in his comments, the Radbaz, Rabbi David ibn Shlomo ibn Zimra, very important Acharon, who's a rabbi in Egypt, and then he was a rabbi, he moved to Eretz Israel, and he was a rabbi in Jerusalem and in Tzfat, and he sat on the Beit Din of Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch in Tzfat, and he wrote thousands and thousands of tshuvot, the Radbaz. We've discussed him in the past here. So the Radbaz also has a commentary to the Rambam, and in his comments to the Rambam, Hilchot Malachim, Perek Gimel Halacha Chet, where the Rambam is talking about someone who's Moreid B'melech Yisrael. We said just a few moments ago that it's a capital offense to rebel against the king of Israel. You're Moreid B'malchut, capital crime. Okay, very serious. But the Radbaz there, he says, and what are we talking about? We're talking about a rebelling against the king. So you could say, well, who has the status of a king? Maybe this guy who was appointed by the people and not by a Sanhedrin and not by a Navi, maybe he does not have the status of the king. And then maybe I can rebel against him. So it's in that context that the Radbaz writes, V'hai melech hainu shehumlach al pi Navi, like we said previously, the king is a king who is elected, appointed by a prophet and also by the Sanhedrin. Ideally, you need both. And where if underlined, oh, she'iskimu alav kol Yisrael, or he is someone that all of Israel, through consensus, decides to elect. That gives him the status of the king. So I think this really works well with this concept that we saw in this important Tshuvah of Rav Kook, that it's about the consensus of the nation. They have the authority, even without a Sanhedrin, even without a Navi, to appoint a Melech. And even in the absence of a king, they can appoint a governor or elect officials, create a government. Okay? Now, it's not only a king. Here in source number 6, the Torah at the beginning of Parshat Shoftim, here in source number 6, it's Dvarim Perek Ted Zayin, Pasuk Yud Chet, the Torah says, Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha b'chol sharecha. You're supposed to place judges or appoint judges and officers in all of your cities. The Torah requires us to establish a just and equitable society. And this mitzvah here includes creating a central supreme court as well as local district courts. Okay? Bechol sharecha. Right? In each and every city. As well as appointing shotrim, officers to enforce the law. Because without a government, there would be total anarchy. So obviously, there is a system in place where we are allowed to elect officials, to appoint governors over ourselves, because otherwise it would be total anarchy. And in fact, here at the bottom of the page, in source number 7, I placed a Mishnah from Masechet Avot. It's from the third chapter of Avot. Rabbi Hananya, Zgana Kohanim Omer. Rabbi Hananya, Zgana Kohanim, says, Heve mitpalel bishloma shel machut. You should pray for the welfare of the government. Shel male mora'a ish et re'ehu chayim below. For without the government, in the absence of a government, a man would eat his fellow. People would swallow one another alive, okay, without the fear of the government. Meaning if there are no laws, it would be total anarchy. We've spoken about this Mishnah in the past. We've discussed the Tfilah L'Shlom HaMedina, both the prayer for the welfare of the state of Israel here and prayers that were composed for governments throughout Jewish history in the diaspora. And this, by the way, applies to governments in Chutz La'aretz, to here in the state of Israel, and many consider it to be a requirement, actually, a chuvah, halacha, to pray for the state that you reside in, to pray for peace for the land where you find yourselves. We've spoken about that in the past, seen a lot of sources, okay? But, you know, a democratically elected government ensures that no one will swallow one another alive, okay? But beyond swallowing one another alive, a government ensures a quality of life. You have many pages in the Talmud, many discussions in both the Mishnah and the Gemara about the responsibilities of members of a community to one another. The Bnei Ha'ir. Different responsibilities that the Bnei Ha'ir have to one another.
Just living together. That's not only in the state of Israel, but even wherever the Jew finds himself. You know, shtetl in Europe somewhere. The Mishnah and the Gemara talk about a Parnas, an elected official, a leader, a governor, the Shivat Tuvei Ha'ir, you know, the seven, there's no real good translation of the Shiva Tuvei Ha'ir, but the council, let's call them, the town council, maybe that's, a good translation. That, yeah, we can elect a council to make decisions in the best interest of the community. And so the Gemara, in a number of places, describes the responsibilities that these officials have to their community and even the process of electing these officials and the need for consensus. So take a look here at source number 8. The Gemara in Brachot on Daf Nun Hey records Amar Rabbi Yitzchok Ein ma'amidin parnas al ha-tzibur Ela im kein nimlachim ba-tzibur. One may not appoint a leader over the community unless it's through the consensus of the community. Right? There's no autocratic rule. Okay? No, you have to elect your officials. And if they're not doing the right things, if they're not acting in your interest, you can elect someone else. Okay? So the concept of appointing leaders, electing officials, is not a new concept. And in fact, here in source number 9 and 10, the Ramah discusses the process of electing officials. The Ramah writes here that all decisions concerning the community require consensus and the support of the majority. Okay, here at source number 9, the Shulchan Aruch is describing in Choshen Mishpat, Siman Kuf Samach Gimel, the responsibilities that the members of the community have to one another and the leaders of the community have to the community, and they can force one another to pay taxes and to contribute to build a wall. The
the Shulchan Aruch records, it's all based on passages in the Mishnah and the Gemara, to build a wall to protect the city. You know, cities used to require protection. They would build a wall around the city. To build a Beit Knesset, a shul, to purchase Sifrei Torah and Nevi'im and Ketuvim, and other things as well, other things, other responsibilities that the residents have to one another. Okay, there's a sense of communal responsibility. Okay, and then the Rama adds, where I've underlined here in source number 9, Kol tzorchei tzibur she'enan yicholin lashvot atzman, yesh lo shiv kol balei batim hanotnim mas, v'kablu alehem shekol echad yomar dato l'shem shemayim. Yet, you know, we're all taxpayers, so if there is a difference of opinion, everyone should voice their opinion. It has to be l'shem shemayim, it has to be for the sake of heaven. Right? Can't be other agendas and interests, and of course the current political process you could question. Okay, you know, are we doing things l'shem shamayim? But then he continues, v'yelchu achar harov, and you have to go according to the majority. In other words, if there's a difference of opinion, you take a vote. We assume everyone is l'shem shamayim, and majority rules. V'im hamiut Yimanu, harov yicholin lachof otan afilu bidinei goyim ulotzim amon al zeh v'hem tzrichim latet chalkam. And if the minority refuses to participate, the minority disagrees and they don't want to go with the vote, right? There's a vote, there's a decision that's made, and you have a minority that doesn't want to go along with the decision. So the majority can force them. Okay, can impose penalties and fines on them, can take them to court, right? And that's what the Rama is saying here, and can force them to pay. No, there's some sort of at the town council meeting. Now, the Rama, of course, is writing in the 16th century, lived in Krakow, Poland, in the 16th century. So this halacha here is applicable wherever the Jew finds himself. And, you know, if they were in Europe and there was a king, maybe there were leaders, maybe there was a poritz over a certain area, feudal lord. But in many communities throughout Jewish history, the Jews had to govern themselves. They lived in some little shtetl. There was no, there wasn't too much interaction with the Gentiles unless they would come and, you know, cause trouble. But as far as day-to-day governance, right, just maintaining the infrastructure needed in a town, in a community, it was the responsibility was on the Jewish community themselves. And so they would elect officials. Sometimes it was the Rav. Maybe there was a Beis Din that made decisions. Maybe there was a Parnas. Maybe there were Shiva Tuve Ha'ir. Okay, there were different, it looked differently at different points in Jewish history. But this is the system. This is the mechanism. That we elect officials, and we come together, and we make decisions, and we rule by majority, okay? And then the majority rules and has the right to then impose things on the minority. That's what the Rama is writing here. And source number 10, the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama in Choshen Mishpat, Simon Bet, this is in the laws of Dayanim, the laws of Jewish judges. There, the Rama discusses all the different powers, so to speak, that the leadership had, that the town council had, and they can impose fines and punishments, etc. All different types of authority that they had. Now, it's interesting, according to the Rashba, the leaders of a community need not be the wisest of sages, but rather the individuals that the community elects to govern them. You could say today, why should I vote? Who could I vote for? These people don't represent me. Right? They're not the Shiva Tuve Ha'ir. They're not the, you know, the wise council of the city, the council of elders. Who are these people running for Knesset? But, you know, we have this idea in Judaism, Shmuel Bedoro, or Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro, that Yiftach, who was a Jewish judge, was not on the level of Shmuel. But Yiftach, to his generation, like Shmuel to his generation. It's every generation gets the leaders that they deserve. You deserve the leaders you elect. You elected them, you deserve them. Okay? And so the Rashba says, yeah, they don't have to be the wisest among men, so long as there is a consensus, so long as the community elects them, and they have tremendous authority here. At the Rama records in Simon Bet here in source number 10. Okay. Again, they can impose penalties and fines and all sorts of things. Now, I'd like to end by looking together with you at a wonderful letter. This is on the last page. A letter written by Rav Moshe Feinstein in October of 1984. And he's not writing about Israel's elections here, but he's writing about the upcoming U.S. presidential election. 84, so what was that? That was Reagan, I guess Reagan's second term, right? Reagan was elected in 1980, so this was in advance of that election where Reagan ran for re-election. Do you remember who he ran against? I was 3 years old at the time. Who did Reagan run against? Who was the Democratic candidate? The Democratic nominee? No? Mondale? No, that was... I have no idea. Okay. Just nod and pretend you know. Okay. But that's less important. What's more important is what he writes here in this letter. Very powerful. Okay? He writes the following. On reaching the shores of the United States, Jews found a safe haven. The rights guaranteed by the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights have allowed us the freedom to practice our religion without interference and to live in this republic in safety. Now, by the way, this is a theme you find throughout the Tshuvot of Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe calls the United States in a number of places a malchut shel chesed. It's a government of kindness. Okay, he had very positive feelings towards the United States. It provided a safe harbor for him and his family and for many Jews. And this is a theme you find in the Tshuvot of Rav Moshe. He is very, very strong on the importance of Dina de Malchuta, or Dina de Malchuta Dina, following the laws of the land. Okay, and he continues in this letter, a fundamental principle of Judaism is Hakarat HaTov, or Hakaras HaTov. So he writes, recognizing benefits afforded us and giving expression to our appreciation. Therefore, it is incumbent upon each citizen to participate in the democratic system, which guards the freedoms we enjoy. The most fundamental responsibility incumbent on each individual is to register and to vote. Therefore, I urge all members of the Jewish community to fulfill their obligations by registering as soon as possible and by voting. By this, we can express our appreciation and contribute to the continued security of our community. And of course, I'm assuming that, you know, Rav Moshe is not only referring to the community there in the United States, the Jewish community in the United States, but also the community here in Israel at the time. I'm sure he felt that, you know, we have to vote in the best interests of the state of Israel as well. Now, I'll just also add that unlike rabbis of today, notice Rav Moshe is not telling you who to vote for. He's telling you to go out and vote. Perform your civic duty. Today, rabbis just tell you who to vote for. Right? Except me. I won't tell. And that's really just because I have no idea who to vote for. I am politically homeless. Okay. But if Rav Moshe, in this letter, felt so strongly that a citizen of the United States is obligated to perform his or her civic duty and vote in the U.S. elections, Ben Kal Vachomer, all the more so in Israel, especially with all that's at stake. And while, yes, we say the same expression from Mishlei, that the heart of the king is in the hand of Hashem, but it's in our hands to choose our leaders. And so you have many contemporary poskim who have ruled that indeed it is a mitzvah to vote in Israel's elections. You know, even though it's frustrating, a fifth election in 3 years, and we may have a sixth. Okay? You know, I mentioned that in advance of Israel's first elections in 1949, a lot of rabbis came out saying it's a mitzvah to vote, right? They asked the Belzer Rebbe, a mitzvah like eating matzah? He answered, maybe more like a mitzvah like eating maror. But in that first election in 1949, voter turnout was 86.9%. Now, okay, there were a lot less people in the state of Israel in 1949, but 86.9% of Israel's citizens at the time voted, right? And in recent years, major, major decline in voter turnout. As I said, people are frustrated. People are frustrated. But with so many crucial issues hanging in the balance, economic stability, our safety and security, education, just to name a few. We asked this morning, is it a mitzvah to vote in Israel's elections? I think with all that's hanging in the balance, it's a sin, or it would be a sin not to vote. Exercising our civic duty and participating in Israel's elections is both an obligation and an opportunity to build the Jewish state together. I often refer to the state of Israel as an atar binya. It's a construction site that we're building together. So I think we have both an obligation and an opportunity to build this state together and ensure a bright future for our children and their children. So as frustrating as it may feel, I encourage you all to go out and vote next week. Unlike most rabbis, I won't tell you who to vote for. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you all in Mirtz Hashem next Wednesday.